This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's special guest is Ian Halliwell, up for the day from Brighton. And I'm assisted by Dan Wilson. Ian Halliwell is a filmmaker, composer. What else are you, Ian?
Multimedia artist, really.
Okay.
Collagist, do light shows.
Right.
Installations occasionally.
Sound artist? Would you call yourself a sound artist?
No. Possibly.
Okay. All right. And Dan is Dan. You better tell us what you are, because it's too. The description is too long for me to.
Everything you just said, but except filmmaker.
Okay. Yes.
And possibly not multimedia. Actually, just sound.
Right. Okay. And the two of you sort of, we've all come together, as it were, because of this latest release, this symbiosis.
Project Symbiosis.
Project Symbiosis, which we can get onto eventually. But I'd love to talk to you for a while about film, Ian. You mostly work on Super 8, or only work on Super 8?
Not only. A lot of the films that I've made have been on Super 8, or originated on Super 8, or Standard 8.
Right.
But videos, I've always used video as well.
Oh, okay.
So some films may just be video only, some will be more
and you
of a
have
hybrid.
You have a massive archive. I looked on your website and was astounded to see something like, I couldn't even count them all, but you tell me it's over 130 films.
That's right, yeah.
Some of which are available on Vimeo.
Some are on Vimeo and some are on YouTube.
Right, right. Okay. And the ones I noticed on Vimeo, you say extract.
Yeah, well, there didn't seem to be any point in just giving away the whole film for nothing, and then you never really get that many views, particularly. And it at some point in the future, if it was possible, I'd like to do a proper DVD anthology and compile as many of the films as possible and make them available in the full proper versions.
I was quite interested because, being a filmmaker myself, I was quite intrigued to see. I've always been a bit nervous about putting things on Vimeo because of that. Possibility. You say, is it because you're trying to protect the film from being taken, copied in its entirety, or you just
that's not the primary motivation, but that is a consideration,
right.
Worth bearing in mind, certainly.
Do you think that happens? Is that
I doubt it. I don't think they're that sought after, really.
Also, is it fair to say in that you work more with found films and found visual materials?
Not necessarily more. The problem has been in the past few years with the demise of Kodak process paid Super 8. It's made it so much more difficult to produce a film, shooting it, getting it processed with Super 8, as I used to do. I used to go to Jessup's or Boots or wherever, buy the film, shoot it, send it off to Hemel Hempstead and get it back in a week.
Yeah.
Now it's just not possible. It's really quite difficult if you want to shoot on Super 8. I did in 2017, when I made four films on the sculptor William Pye.
Oh.
But it was problematic getting the film, getting the Super 8, because a lot of that was found footage, but I wanted to shoot some footage as well.
So you filmed him?
I did, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So where is he based? Is he
Wandsworth.
Wandsworth,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, so I went to his studio.
Yeah.
And then because he's got the Zemran sculpture just next to the Queen Elizabeth Hall on the South Bank.
Right.
So I invited him to come along, so he was walking around it and I was shooting on Super 8.
Right.
While he was there.
And a lot of your films are, from my point of view, I would call them sort of materialist films. I mean, they're quite, they involve with the actual material of the film decomposing and scratched on or...
Yeah, there's direct animation, essentially.
Right. And would that also include, say, a film like about William Pye? Would you have also used that aesthetic?
On that one, because often I'll use it if the film hasn't turned out very well, and I think, well, I may as well draw all over it and scratch it and then see what might turn out.
Right.
I want to do that.
Okay. And as Dan was saying, some of them are sort of found footage films. I noticed one was shot in Northampton, was it?
Yeah, that's the Elegy for a Power Station. Yeah, that was a Northampton power station being demolished.
Right,
but the film, the cameraman, he had unlimited access while it was being demolished. He must have been working for the electricity board at the time, so working at the power station.
Well,
so you see all his work colleagues
so
coming in.
So that's literally a found documentary film, which you
sort of
worked on.
Often these types of films they come in quite big reels, and there's lots of unusable footage. That it's quite tedious and it doesn't really go anywhere, and it's the particular preoccupation of the cameraman. In this case, he was obsessed by trains. There were these locomotives.
Yeah.
Great though they are, but they were being loaded onto lorries and being driven away, and they spent ages and ages, like about 15 minutes on that. Now, 15 minutes of screen time is a hell of a lot.
When
if there's a reel, say it might be half an hour long, and then it'll end up being sort of 8 minutes long in the final cut.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to sift through and to reorganize.
Right.
And then make the soundtrack as well that fits that
exactly. footage. You're very much all of the films, I think, have a strong emphasis on the soundtrack, which you also compose.
That's right. Yeah.
Does anything come first? Or does it vary?
I nearly always have to cut the film together and have the edit pretty much finished, and then I can start really seriously doing the music.
Right.
But occasionally, I will use a piece of music that I've already finished, and then that will be more of a sound visualization type of piece, generally a video piece where the sound is activating the image, right. And then you can see the kind of patterns that particular sequence of sounds will create.
A film, Holes, that you've done that's quite impressive, and I'm wondering, it's actually made from the end bits of film.
Yeah, it's the beginning and the end of a standard 8 Kodak film.
Where the holes are visible.
Yes, it's a sort of serial number punched into the...
And the soundtrack to that was, as I remember it, it was all synchronized to the holes almost. It was like a...
It's kind of like a pulse-generating code.
So was the image activating the sound, or was the sound...
No, it's not quite so close with that one. It's more of an intuitive... A lot of the films that I do, the sound isn't literally activating the image, I try and get the sound so close that you might think it does.
Like the McGurk effect, but where you see the visual stimulus and you assume that it's synchronized to the sound. I always assume that Holes was perfectly synchronized.
No, it's not actually.
Okay, that's interesting.
So, do you edit the Super 8, or do you edit on video?
Well, with Holes, actually, because it's an ongoing film, so every time I find these little sequences, only about 1 second long, with the holes punched in, then I splice them into the main film.
Okay.
And then at some point, periodically, I'll do a telecine, and then so the holes gets longer. Okay. So in the early 90s, when I started the film, I thought it was only about 15 seconds long or something like that, right. And then I thought, yeah, I could just carry on, keep adding to this, and so it's become a never-ending film in my life.
What was your first? When was your first film?
Well, I started because I didn't know anything about filmmaking whatsoever, but I was really intrigued by it. Animation, I was intrigued by, but these things, they seemed almost inaccessible. But then realizing that you could pick up projectors and cameras at car boot sales and jumble sales. Jumble sales really back then, but then car boot sales started to come along.
But what year do you...
So that would be right at about 1990 or
right.
so.
Okay.
A friend had his dad's cine camera, and I remember we went out on our bikes around Brighton and just filming things, and when we watched it back, it was just so exciting. I thought, this is great. I could really, really get into this. And we were in a band together, Giant Clams we were called, and we had people come and do light shows for us.
Right.
And they would have slide projectors and cine projectors and things like that. And all this was just starting to open up at the time. And I was playing drums and guitar and bass. And then we had these projections onto us. We had a full band at points. And it was really, really fascinating what the potential was for visual elements. And there's I want to have a go at that.
There's a book just come out, actually. It came out in September. It's called... something like Artists Moving Image in Great Britain Since 1989, and it's a sort of thumping great tome.
So I'm not in it then?
I'm not in it, and you're not in it.
Well.
But I was curious, is it because you started, your filmmaking probably started in 1989 or 1990?
It was about then, yeah.
And you've been making films since, consistently, which is about 30 years, 130 films. Yeah. And you're nowhere in this book. But neither am I, and neither
is... Well, this is, I think, quite a serious thing. These are serious omissions, I think.
Well, absolutely. So after that, I delved into other histories of avant-garde film, like the David Curtis book and another two or three, Al Rees, so on. You're not mentioning any of them.
No.
Why not?
You should ask them if they were around. I've met David Curtis a couple of times, but he was just not interested in what I was doing whatsoever. I was at a screening because I was a projectionist, and he told me he was writing a book about expanded cinema. I said, oh yeah, I've made an expanded cinema film. It's with the Megatherm. It's this machine I built, and you project a Super 8 film onto the machine, and it plays a soundtrack by itself by reacting to the light content in the film. And he just changed the subject.
Right.
So fair enough.
I find it extraordinary. Because you're obviously a prolific filmmaker. You've got a distinguished career in filmmaking, and you're a totally independent filmmaker.
Yeah.
You're not financed by the Arts Council.
That's the problem, though.
Right.
That is the problem. Being an independent filmmaker is not a very good career move in this country.
No.
At all.
Right.
Because once you have established that you can be autonomous and fund the films yourself, because they don't take very much money, really, to make a film. The problem is the distribution of the work afterwards.
Yes.
But that's not how the system works. The system wants to give people money to make films.
Yeah.
And then they're sort of beholden to the whole machinery of the establishment then, and it becomes a kind of closed loop.
Right.
The Arts Council gives money out, the filmmaker receives that, makes the film according to what they've told the funder they're going to do, and then the distributor steps in and they all have a vested interest in promoting that film.
Right.
But if you've made a film yourself, nobody has a vested interest in that film.
Apart from you.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
yes.
So you're always up against it because it's very difficult to get work out there because there's so many other people making films and good films as well. And you've got this body of film that is being pushed and promoted all the time by the establishment. And the establishment is so powerful that you're always going to be stuck. And then when you get these books that you mentioned that don't even give you a helping hand.
No.
Then it's even worse.
So distribution then, are your films unique objects? Are they like single pieces of art, as it were, you know, is each film
because the way I work is always with a telecine. If it's going to be a Super 8 or Standard 8 film, then I'll do a sort of a rough cut, perhaps. If it's direct animation, obviously I'll have drawn all over the film, but then you have to get that to a stage where you can edit it and work with it. And so that I do my own telecines at home in my bedroom,
okay,
and then get those into laptop. Right. And then I can edit.
So if anyone wants to see one of your films, apart from on Vimeo, say, what do they do? Hire them directly from you?
Yeah, like when I made the Practical Electronica film on Fred Judd and electronic music in Britain, 2011, people were interested to see that film. And so I ended up basically distributing it myself.
Right.
And it really worked. There's a model that could work, that could benefit independent filmmakers, without having the establishment involved in telling you what's going to be shown and what isn't. Because people were just emailing me to say, can we screen Practical Electronica? And I said, yeah, of course. So it's £60 if you want to screen it. Okay. I'll send you the disc.
Yeah.
And if you want me to come and introduce it, it's £100 and you pay me train fare.
Right. Okay.
And it worked. I screened that film about 25 times, so it's way more successful than any other film.
How was it shown the first time then? How did people latch onto it initially?
Well, I got it shown at the Barbican.
Uh-huh.
It just was a really resonant film, it seemed.
The timing was right. And while I was making the film...
But how did that get noticed in the first place? You know, what was it a submission or...
It was because I compiled with the public information, the record label... Alex was working at the British Library Sound Archive, and he was interested in doing a release of Fred Judd. And I'd met Mrs. Judd, Fred's widow, and so I had access to the tapes.
Right.
And so I compiled the anthology for public information to release. So that was perfect. The CD was coming out, and the film was being made. And
so there was a degree of luck there in terms of
the timing was perfect.
Sure.
And then for some reason the Barbican agreed to screen the film. Subsequently, whenever I've contacted the Barbican, I can't even get a reply, but they did reply that time, and they screened it, and it was great. And the Judd family all came. There were different generations of Judds all turned up, and
you've seen this film.
Yeah, okay. I was there, and Ian was surrounded by Judds.
Who are the Judds? Tell me what the...
This was the family, Fred's their relatives.
Yeah. But I don't know anything about that. Why are they the subject of the film? Or
Essentially, he was the grandfather or the husband or the father of these different generations of the Judd family.
Right.
So the film was about his electronic music.
I see. Okay.
And
that's the missing link.
As F.C. Judd, in his author. He did all kinds of books on remote control boats. But he did this one that really is the two books, actually. One of them on music on Cret and one on I can't remember the titles of them. There's one.
The second one is because one's from the I think 1961, the Electronic Music and Music on Crete. So it's one of the first textbooks on electronic music in the world. So it's a very important book, that one. The second one, the electronics one, that's about 10 years later, and he's sort of lost it a little bit. He's not quite so in touch with what's going on.
Okay.
And he's sort of recanting somewhat as well, saying that you need to be trained to be able to make music, whereas his whole approach up to that point was you don't need to be. Yeah. You can get so much from these hobbyist magazines that he was writing for, Amateur Tape Recording, and then he wrote articles for Practical Wireless, Practical Electronics, Wireless World, and all these other publications. Yeah. So he's prolific in his article writing.
Right, right.
As well as being a composer as well.
Yeah, but he over time, as the electronic music became more under the control of these established ways of doing things, that amateur kind of approach was sidelined, really, and frowned upon, if anything, and not given any credence.
Well, it sounds like even by the people themselves that Judd's, Judd's kind of almost folding in on himself by the sound of it. That's a revelation, actually, to me. Because I've read both the books, but not that closely, obviously. I think that's quite interesting. Because this is a common thing. I don't know if you're still on the film subject.
Oh, yeah, carry on.
But Ian is the compiler of the great A to Z tape leaders book of composers. Okay. And F.C. Judd is featured in there, among lots of other composers. Right. And there seems to be a common theme among the people profiled in the book, that they almost come to be quite ashamed of their experimental phase in the 60s and 50s.
Maybe ashamed is perhaps too strong a word, but certainly not really interested in looking back on it, thinking it was not really of much consequence. Terence DeWire was another one. He just got to a point in the mid 70s, he just stopped making electronic music, turned his back on it, and that was it. Mm. Even though he'd written two books as well.
Really?
Influential books.
What was it?
Terence DeWire.
Okay. Right.
He's still alive, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Oh, he's approaching 100, I think.
Wow. Right. Well, so, okay. Well, we can eventually get on to this symbiosis project. I'm just curious about just a bit more about film, the distribution aspect. Are your films with the Lux?
There are some films with the Lux, but I realised that their interest in my films was rapidly diminishing, and there was very little point in sending them any further films.
Right.
Because communication is so scant with them. Lightcone have got some films as and occasionally, but you never get paid with Lightcone. You have to really chase them up to get anything out of them.
Right.
I thought if
Lightcone is in Paris, of course, which is to say.
And it seems
do they have Super 8 films, or do you send them a file?
It's all video.
Video. Yeah. Okay. You don't have a problem with that aspect of like filming on film, but then projecting digitally?
Yeah, well, that's the only way feasibly to do it, because you have to do all the post-production, you have to add the soundtrack, get it all in sync, and Super 8 has never really been a proper serious projection format anyway.
No.
Maybe it's a bit different if you work with 16mm and you might want to have a print made and use that for projection, but you don't have prints made of Super 8 films, really, not in my experience anyway.
Sure.
So it's always been like that. When I first started, right at the 1990, it had to have a telecine. I just had top loading VHS at the time, and that's what I was using, and a little TV. Yeah. And that's how I would make the music to the film, by keep rewinding the VHS tape and watching it, and then eventually I would borrow a friend's SVHS camera and do a telecine.
Right. Okay. And you kind of would you see yourself as part of the Brighton School of filmmaking in the tradition of Jeff Keane, perhaps? Or
well, I made a film about Jeff Keane in 2000, an animation film, because I used to know him, and he was a lovely old fella, and I used to cycle up to his house every now and again and call him for a cup of tea, and he was a really nice bloke. And
Is there something about Brighton that creates this sort of this little demi-monde of filmmakers who kind of then venture out from there?
I'm not sure, really. There's not that many.
No,
people.
Okay.
It just happens that there is that tradition with the Hove pioneers. Yeah, right at the dawn of cinema, really.
Right.
And so they were important. There was an exhibition a couple of years ago at Brighton Museum. So they started with the Hove pioneers, and then it sort of brought it right up to the present day.
Right. Right.
But what they failed to do was to connect any of the filmmakers up, because quite a lot of us, you do know those other people, even if you're not necessarily friends with them, you know who they are.
Yeah.
But it made no attempt to connect anybody up, that the fact that I made a film about Jeff Keane, or that I did a film soundtrack for a Ben Rivers film, something like that. The audience would have not known anything about the background to any of these filmmakers.
Almost like it's too much work for researchers to look at the grizzle that's holding all the nodes together.
But these are the interesting things, are the facts behind what is obvious. It's what else is there behind all that?
All right. Well, perhaps we should get on to this project of yours, Project Symbiosis. And Dan, you might have to assist me with this line of questioning. Tell me about this. This is a new CD?
It is a new CD, yeah.
Okay. And what's the story of this?
So the idea, it was a kind of outgrowth of Tape Leaders and the research I did for the book, because Malcolm Poynton was one of the composers featured. And I met Malcolm Poynton's widow as well, Barbara, and she had a lot of his old tapes, and she had this version of Symbiosis. Symbiosis was created for Practical Electronics magazine in 1975 to go alongside the Minisonic synthesizer construction project.
Right.
So it was a brilliant idea that for any constructor who could build that synthesizer, then here was a piece of experimental music that you could create with your synthesizer that you spent 5 months building. And
okay.
The fact that it was a very avant-garde kind of piece of music for a mainstream magazine to promote, and Malcolm Poynton was obviously in the experimental area of electronic music, so they entrusted him to create this graphic score, to create this piece of electronic music, which then mainstream hobbyist
constructors... So he created the score for the magazine?
Indeed, yeah.
Okay. And the circuit diagram for the actual synthesis?
No, so that was Doug Shaw. He was the electronics engineer and designer. So he came up with the Practical Electronics synthesizer project in 1973.
Okay.
But that ran for over a year. So imagine trying to build a synthesizer. And it takes 13 months of Practical Electronics issues to follow through this project. You know, it's a big thing. And then they realized that was such a huge project that maybe something more straightforward, a bit more simple, like the Minisonic. Yeah. So it's operated with a stylus as well, and that really appealed to me.
How does the stylus come into it?
So the stylus, rather than a keyboard, because that was the other thing about the way electronic music and synthesizers had developed by the mid-70s, that the synthesizer became a keyboard instrument, whereas in the 60s it wasn't.
So, right. So the stylus is actually a solid piece of metal, that just makes contact.
It's not a record stylus. You mean a pen?
Yeah, yeah. Ah. So very, very much like the stylophone idea.
Right. And what do you write on then?
So it's a metal strip that is subdivided, and each part of that strip has resistors running off into the circuitry, and that creates the subdivisions of an octave.
Right.
So you can only get one note.
It's only monophonic.
Yeah.
Okay. And so have you, as various people have contributed tracks to this.
Yes. So what happened was I had Malcolm Poynton's version, and then by sheer fluke, Paul Williams, I didn't know who he was, but he got in touch and said, I created the version of Symbiosis in 1978. And I said, I'd love to hear it. So he sent me his version. And I thought, it's brilliant, just comparing the two versions, because they were the same but different.
Right.
And that's the fascinating thing about it, because people are following the score, but the instructions, there's a set of instructions that go with it as well. But basically, you can get most of it from just looking at the graphic score. For anybody that can't read music notation,
creates the difference then?
So it's in the timbres that are used with the instrumentation that you've got, because not everybody, well, hardly anyone now will have a Minisonic. Peter Keane, actually one of the contributors, has built a Minisonic according to the original circuit diagrams. I sent him over the issues of the Practical Electronics magazine, and he built one. But most people obviously won't be able to do that.
No. So there's various pictures in the little booklet that comes with it. How many contributors are there?
So there are 10 versions. It's nine others.
The Paul Williams one is the only kind of one that was found that you found that was actually a reader of the original Practical Electronics that managed to just read the issues and build the thing and make this thing. There could be others out there then.
I would love it if there were other people that did actually tackle it and still have a recording somewhere. It would be brilliant.
The magazine would encourage people to do this thing, to follow the graphic score.
Yes.
And was there room for interpretation, or were they just supposed to slavishly follow the text, as it were?
Well, anything is up to you, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
How far you want to take it and how accurate you want to be.
It's more an educational thing, really, rather than...
I wouldn't say education necessarily, because it was meant as an inspiration, I think, to use, rather than just like the stylophone, is just aimed at people doing little ditties with the stylus.
Right.
They have song books and they have old traditional folk tunes and traditional songs that you'd be singing at infant school. This was radically different.
Is it something that a child could have done?
Yes.
It's quite complex. The score is a bit, for Ian, who's a pro at these things, it's for someone that's coming in from nowhere. There's all kinds of I think even some of the people contributing have misinterpreted the first part, whether that was ring modulation or amplitude modulation.
Well, it depends how strict you want to be. It can be a very liberal approach to the score if you want, and other people will want to be as accurate as uh-huh. they possibly can. So it's completely open to the person who interprets the score.
And it reveals.
So a very young person could do it. It may not be 100% accurate according to the strictest interpretation.
But if they come across the magazine and they had one of these stylophone things, they could have had a go at perhaps.
Well, not with the stylophone back then. I mean, they've got they came out with a much bigger 350S stylophone. You probably could just about do it with that, and it had a twin stylus.
So these are all illustrated in the booklet.
This is the equipment that the actual contributors have used contemporary with their new
versions.
But
it's all old equipment, isn't it?
Mostly, yes.
Well, but
not exclusively.
Yeah, okay. It's to do with that. Not I haven't got a Mini Sonic, and I contributed one.
Right.
So the idea was to just make do with what you've got. And it's what Ian calls creative soldering as well. You've got a lot of people that do creative soldering.
Yeah.
Other words for this are hardware hacking and circuit bending. These are all loaded terms because circuit bending is actually Reed Ghazala's definition, which is chaos, anarchy, circuit board anarchy. The hardware hacking is Nick Collins, a professor and view. And Ian's term, which I think has its own aura about this, creative soldering, is trying to attain a degree of control over a circuit creatively in a way that maybe it's not intended for, maybe that destabilizes a circuit in some way, or it also includes building circuits from scratch as well, which is these all nuanced definitions. But the fact is that you have to indulge in a bit of creative soldering to achieve the score in the absence of a Mini Sonic.
Is that right? You have to solder?
With
a heated thing and melting wires?
Well, not while you're actually composing the piece.
Yeah.
That would be interesting.
All my equipment was self-built. All those machines in the booklet that you can see. So for my version, it all comes from self-built equipment.
Oh.
And they're extremely visual things, your equipment. And they're all prefixed heli devices.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
Except the Percussi Mate, which isn't a heli prefix. But they're all really, I mean, you can see there's whoever built these. If you were just coming into a gig and you saw Ian performing, there's a real cinematic sensibility to it. It's like they're so visual. The coloured lights... it's like the McGurk effect again. It influences the way you actually listen to the sound almost, because it's a real...
Do you perform
theatrical...
with it live, as it were?
Yes.
So does it have a visual aspect as well, like almost like a kind of What are those organs called that were kind of like
colour organs? Yeah, well, I built a sound to light box, so there are different boxes that I can feed.
So you're you're playing this, I don't know what to call it, machine, the contraption, whatever. You play this, and it might create a visual aspect as well, like its own light show, which is interpreting the score.
In a live situation, yeah, it will be different to the symbiosis. I'll have written out a kind of a score for myself to follow, so I know where the knobs have got to be turned, and so I know which helitron is going to plug into the next one. Otherwise, it could be a big mess. So I do try and map out stages during the performance where I know I'm going to be next, and so I can prepare and plug in all the necessary leads to set up for the next kind of transition into a new sort of sound passage.
Okay.
But the output will be going obviously to the PA, but it can also go to these other heli boxes with flashing lights and things that will be reacting to the sound.
Right.
Because to perform, there's nothing worse to me than just seeing someone just staring at a laptop screen and not really trying to engage with the audience or make it an audiovisual, give it audiovisual impact, which that's surely the whole point of performing.
Yeah.
You're there to engage the audience.
Okay. And so, Dan, how did you come to be involved in this? How did you come to make a contribution?
Ian asked me, and he knew that I had an unusual device, which I found at a car boot sale, which used a stylus. And it is not as sophisticated as the Mini Sonic, but it's got some unusual features in that it's in a weird tuning. It's in a microtonal tuning because the resistors they've used are in a whole number integers, and you end up with a very out-of-tune stylophone-like device. And Ian said, why not use it? And he told me all the other contributors were Peter Keane. And so I began, it's quite hard work because I haven't really got a studio space. I know that Ian's got a very tidy and studio with and I'm just in a mess, really. You can see the pictures in the booklet, actually. You can see everyone's studio.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting to see how people work.
I can't see a picture of your studio.
Well, it's a close-up of the Maddytronic, actually. It was made by someone called Lynn Maddy.
Right.
And it was actually Ian that called it the Maddytron, which I thought was quite good. I have never been able to track down who Lynn Maddy was. It had a little drawer. You opened it, and there was a piece of paper that said, for bubbly sounds, use a spoon. So the spoon would have been the stylus, and with a combination of
that's interesting. So the implement that you use would affect the sound. So
supposedly, I don't see how a spoon would make bubbly sounds, but maybe people had a different way of listening to electronic sound, maybe in the 60s, that would interpret it. I don't know. It's now, I think anything you use, a knife or a spoon, would make a sound.
But it has to be connected up to the circuitry to be able to make the contact.
Yeah.
Should we play a track?
We should play Dan's version.
Let's play Dan's version. So this is Dan Wilson's version of, is it Malcolm Poynton?
Malcolm Poynton's symbiosis.
Malcolm Poynton's symbiosis. What happened to where's Malcolm Poynton these days?
He died. Got Alzheimer's. He died.
So did he have a career as a composer?
Yeah, he did. But he was largely in education. But he did these standalone electronic pieces as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
So this is Dan Wilson's contribution to Project Symbiosis, an Ian Halliwell project issued in 2019.
It came out. I got the delivery of 200 CDs just before Christmas.
Right.
And
okay.
It's been made available just in the past couple of weeks.
Where is it available?
So I did it myself, but okay. Public Information have generously agreed to host it on their Bandcamp page, so it's available through
and that. Do people pay for that?
Yes,
you buy each track or something, or you buy the whole thing?
I thought it's so important to be able to see the score, read the booklet, that I didn't want it just to be down like digital downloads. It's just a CD only. You have to buy the CD.
You buy the CD.
And then you get everything with it, and then you've got the proper experience then.
Right. And how did people find it? They look for Project Symbiosis, Ian Halliwell.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dan, you were saying how you came to... perform the piece or to construct, compose your...
You imagine in your mind the Mini Sonic with all its abilities and capabilities and just try to think, how would I achieve these effects using what I've got in front of me, which happened to be that the aforementioned MADI synthesizer, the mysterious microtonal synthesizer, and including some creatively soldered keyboards, a Casio SK keyboard, which is put into the Arabic tuning, which had these Casio keyboards had an Easter egg, which are the little unknown parts of the chip, which were reserved for worldwide models. And in the Middle East, the Casio happened to have a different tuning system. So I was trying to make a microtonal tuning system. And it's a sampling keyboard as well. So there were the samples of feedback spring reverbs. I was trying to make a just intonation realization of this piece, which is a bit pushing against the score, really, because it was never supposed to be a microtonal piece. But I thought it would add an extra dimension of, personalization. That's the joy of this album. They're all the same tracks, but each one reveals the personality of the creator slightly, and the studio they work in as well.
Because strangely, when you first described it to me, you sort of said, well, every track's the same. But they're not the same at all, are
they?
They're
not the same.
No.
And that's the beauty of it. But everybody's doing the same piece.
Right. And the track's all the same length as well.
Because if you follow the instructions properly, you will get it to about 7 minutes.
It has
long.
To be the same length. That's part of the criteria.
Yeah. Give or take a number of seconds.
Okay.
I did propose to Ian, can I do a post-electronic version using wheelbarrows, cranks and pulleys? because my thing, which is coming, if I can plug this, it's coming out in February, also Troll Binnish, post-electronic music. It's all post-electronic music, which is electronic sounding music made on acoustic systems. But Ian said, no, this is an electronic project. It would have been stood out like a sore thumb if I'd done that. So it was... an electronic version that just happened. It fits in quite nicely. I think it's a great counterpoint to all the other pieces. There's a great one that Tom Richards' contribution.
With his mini-oramics.
That was all done on the mini-oramics. And that's actually, in itself, is quite an unusual and discussion-worthy thing, but maybe there's not time to talk about that, which is a reconstruction of Daphne Oram's long-forgotten mini-oramics device.
Peter Keane, another one of the contributors, he's built an original oramics.
The original.
I think this is the Peter Keane track. Uh-huh. This is track six. Does that seem right? Does that sound right? Peter Keane.
Yeah.
And this is done in 2017.
Yeah, because he actually did two versions, and he sent me them both on cassette. And they weren't exactly high fidelity. And I played them both, and I thought, wow, there's some brilliant sequences. But neither of them are completely consistent. So I emailed him and said, would it be okay if I made a hybrid of the two? So that I select the best passages and put them together into one.
Right.
And he said, yeah, sure, that's okay. Fine.
So that's what this is.
Mm.
Okay. So it has a very cassette quality to it as well, which I really liked about Peter Keane's one. There's a grip to it. There's a kind of almost impurity, which is really enjoyable. You can hear the tape saturation at points.
Yeah.
He builds radionics machines as well. Peter Keane is
That's in your neck of the woods, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I was surprised that usually you assume that people building electronic things are very rational, hard-headed people.
Yeah.
Numbers, resistances in ohms, voltages, and then suddenly he builds radionics machines as well. So it's a real unusual. It's quite enjoyable. You can hear the tape hiss.
This sounds very different to yours.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same score, though. It's a,
right. Did you want to move on to this other project that you have, this other CD?
Well, I thought it might be quite nice as a follow-on because of the stylus connection. In 2018, it was the 50th anniversary of the stylophone, and Dubrec, who manufactured the stylophone, that was the original company, they've been reconstituted, and they reissued the stylophone. And then they
launched... When did they do that? When did they reissue?
Maybe 5 years ago. I'm not quite sure. But for 2018, it was the 50th anniversary of the original stylophone coming out. Right. And so they launched this competition for a piece of music, two minutes long or less, had to use a stylophone in some shape or form, and submit that to the competition. And I thought, yeah, I reckon I might just have a go at that.
Right.
Because I've got, for Symbiosis, I used several Helitron stylus machines. So I thought I could use these, and I've got various old stylophones as well that I could also incorporate.
Right.
And then so I ended up doing two tracks, and I submitted one. Of course, it didn't win, and it seemed a bit of a sham, actually, the competition. Because you're meant to be able to win a gold stylophone. And there are all these other prizes as well, because they've released this Gen X1 stylophone, which is absolutely brilliant. It's a really good miniature synthesizer.
Right.
I got one for Christmas, actually. It was excellent.
I've seen a lot of new stylophones on the market now with MP3 capability and all things, but I think this one that you're referencing actually like an analog synthesizer almost.
Yeah, yeah.
So does this basically bypasses the keyboard system?
Well, I like that because I was saying earlier that when the synthesizer became the domain of the keyboard player, then that rules out a lot of people who are not natural keyboardists from using the synthesizer.
Was the original one a Bechler? Was that right? The original synthesizer?
The history of synthesizers, you could say the RCA synthesizer.
But it was the one with the keyboard that won out, didn't it?
That was largely down to Moog synthesizers because so many rock musicians adopted the keyboard synthesizer, and then that became the province of the organist or the piano player.
Right.
So anybody else. I mean, obviously Brian Eno was a bit of an exception in Roxy Music. But for most groups, Hawkwind again another exception. But mostly it was the keyboard player who had control of the synthesizer, and then he'd be using the keyboard to play melodies.
Right.
And rather than it being this amazing noise generator with all sorts of fantastic possibilities, then it became like a substitute organ.
Yes,
and that's a bit disappointing. I think,
right?
For what it can do.
I think people have argued that it kind of went wrong there in a way.
It's sort of personal opinion, isn't it? But it's, I mean, to me, it just seemed to lose so much of the potential.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah.
And that also drained away a lot of the experimental music that actually broke through into the mainstream in the 50s, 60s, maybe early 70s. Because it hadn't been co-opted by the commercial interests, and that's what seemed with the keyboard synthesizer. It seemed to consolidate that the avant-garde experimentation was no longer wanted or welcome in the mainstream.
Right.
You can see it in the design. It's slowly pushed out, almost. The noise-making aspects are just slowly pushed further into the background.
Shall we play a track from this other CD then?
Yeah,
Does this exist as a CD? My
dream was to have it as a 7-inch single. So you'd have these two stylophone generated tracks on B side.
Does it have a name?
So one is called Stylus Operator, the other one is Helitronic Stylophonic, which is the one I submitted for the competition.
Okay. Well, that was amazing. You should release that. Yes, that's a good one. So what is it, you're saying about this competition?
It was the gold stylophone was the top prize, and then there were a series of runners-up prizes.
You must have got the runner-up prize.
And so. I thought, I might be in with a chance. And it was Tony Visconti was meant to be one of the judges alongside the Dubrec bosses. And after a time, after the closing date, I was thinking, well, when are they going to announce the winner then? And then a month went by and a couple of months. And then after about 3 months, like, oh, is this a Swiss? What's going on with it? Yeah. So I emailed Dubrec and said, oi, when are you going to announce the winners? And then they emailed back and said, oh, yeah, it's going to be soon.
Yeah.
And then a few weeks later, it was just this one person won all the prizes, the gold stylophone and all the runners-up prizes. And he did this pathetic video on YouTube. It was so bad.
Gosh. Well, that sounds scandalous.
Like it's a complete stitch-up.
It was.
Sounds a bit corrupt. All right. Shall we?
We should just play the entry that I did for the competition.
This is the entry. The next one is this is the entry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can talk.
So judge for yourself.
Okay. So that was your entry,
yes.
Which is there's about 20 seconds left. Mm. What is there any future for this track?
Well, it would be nice to release it and maybe we compile a longer anthology of different tracks because there's plenty in the archive.
What do you make of it, Dan?
Well, it's epic. It's a stylophone epic.
Oh, that is the end. Okay. All right, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guests still are Dan Wilson, sound artist, and Ian Halliwell, who's come up especially from Brighton. Ian Halliwell, prolific Super 8 filmmaker and composer, and who's just released this Project Symbiosis on your own label?
Yeah.
Okay. Any comments, Dan?
Yes, let's hand over this gift, which is a found piece of a camera with a cartridge still inside it.
Yes, K40.
So maybe, I don't know how you can develop it.
It's a little bit of a problem with the Kodachrome to get those processed.
Oh, so we may never know what's on this found camera.
No? Is it still Super 8 still kind of
the Kodachrome required a certain kind
of
developing process,
yes.
Which is much more difficult for people to do.
And so you can tell that this is on Kodachrome.
You can see the K40 and in the window of the camera.
Okay, right.
So you can see that's what it is.
Right. Yeah, it was a shame, wasn't it, about Kodachrome? I only shot Standard 8. I never actually did Super 8 at all.
The Standard 8 is much more prone to different accidents and things because I've made quite a few films with people's home movies where something has gone wrong.
Okay.
And it's the accident, it's the really interesting thing. It's not what they're filming, it's the fact that they haven't loaded the film and the camera correctly.
Right.
And there's all sorts of mistakes and blips and things that, that occur.
Yeah. Yes.
The magic of the glitch.
Yeah.
And well, with Standard 8, you could, I found that you could double expose it because it was 16mm film, you could run it through
you had to turn it around anyway.
Could you do that with Super 8?
No.
No, exactly.
Because that was the problem with Super 8, that it was much more idiot-proof, so it tended to inhibit all the mistakes that
were there.
It was
in a cassette,
wasn't
it? Yeah.
So you just plugs into the camera, whereas you have to thread the Standard 8 into the mechanism. And then once you've shot half of it, you have to open up the camera and turn it around and rethread it.
So I've
come across quite a few films that have been double exposed.
Right.
Quite interesting effect.
Dan, we've got 20 seconds left.
Oh, well,
fill the air.
Something profound.
Fill the air.
No, give it let Ian. I haven't got anything profound to say.
All right, well, I'll thank you once again.
Well, thanks for the invitation. Thanks for
the magic is in the stylus.
Brilliant. With that quote, we can end That's the show. Memorable. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.